And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, everyone. This is Martin Willis, your host. And we have another good show for you coming up this evening with our guest, Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark, and she's going to talk about her new book and past books. And before we get into that, we're going to be having Alejandro Rojas from openminds.tv, and he's going to talk to us about the latest UFO events and last year's total UFO events. He worked out some type of great graph for that, and he'll be talking about that coming up. So if you want to subscribe to us to hear the second hour, we are now 2 hours live on the Dark Matter Radio Network. But if you want to listen to the second hour as a podcast, you need to support us. And we're not asking too much, only like 23 cents a week. It's a dollar a month. And all you have to do to access that is go to getjoyride.com/podcastUFO. We have all that information right on our website. And if you have any problems or questions, you can email me at martin@podcastufo.com. We're going to be doing a shout-out later on this month and a contest for all the people that have helped us out at the $10 level to win a free T-shirt this month. And we're going to have some T-shirts printed up and ready out and when we go out to Phoenix coming up in February. So it's time to bring on Alejandro with the news. What's going on, Alejandro?
Not much, just chilling.
Speaking of chilling, didn't you guys get a cold blast out that way?
Yes, we did.
Finally.
Yeah, it got down to 30 degrees in the middle of the night.
That's like unheard of, right?
No, it happens. Every year for a couple days. You do know we have a couple days of a freeze that's in the middle of the night, but it was still much warmer than Colorado, which is where I was during, you know, the Christmas vacation. So even in the middle of the night out here, but it did snow. So my girlfriend's daughter ran outside and was making freaky noises and running around, and I got a little bit of video. I think I posted a picture on somewhere, but yeah, in the middle of the night, there was a little bit of snow. I mean, it didn't stay on the ground at all. It just immediately melted, and it was mixed with rain. But there was a little bit of snow about a week ago in the middle of the night.
Doesn't Phoenix, like, close down when it snows, basically?
No.
Oh, you're prepared?
No. It just if it were to really snow. But that was just for maybe an hour in the middle of the night, a few flakes that didn't even, stick to the ground. But, the surrounding areas, like there are mountains around where the snow stays. And then, of course, there are further north, actually, just maybe an hour or two away, you've got standing snow. You know, you have Flagstaff, you have Sholo, where, you know, Travis Walton lives and his whole experience went down. I mean, that's just like Colorado or something. It's the high country and higher country. And, it has actual full-on snowy winters.
Yeah, I know. Some of the highest snow banks I've ever seen were in the Flagstaff area.
Really?
I went up through there in February a number of years ago. And, yeah, deep, deep snow. So it happens. But anyway, it's only going to be 12 degrees minus here tonight. So we're doing okay in the state of Maine. What's going on in the skies this last week?
Well, and I was going to say the skies here are sunny, and we're already in the 70s. So I didn't even have to wear a jacket this morning when I got out of bed. Really warm. But in the skies, there are – UFOs. UFOs. In fact, now that, you know, the year is gone and it's been a little while, MUFON sent out their numbers, and I took all their numbers, as I usually do, for the year and crunched them, and I wrote a story about the top UFO hotspots for 2014. So what I did is I took the states, the countries, I totaled up all of the sightings. I put them in an Excel. You know, from my corporate background, I know how to make pivot tables and graphs and all this fancy analytical stuff to see what's going down out there. So I listed the top states that have reported UFOs. However, those list very much like the top states with the highest population. So you have California, Texas, Florida, New York, all of those at the top. So what I also do every year is put that versus population. So in other words, I figure out reports per 100,000 person so that you really, you know, how many places are having more UFO reports per person. And usually those came out pretty normal. You usually have Arizona, Colorado, Nevada towards the top. As you do this year, the Southwest is always up there. I think maybe because there's more clear skies. There's also more, you know, Air Force bases and stuff like that. Could be that sort of thing. But who went to the top when I did per population? Oregon, surprisingly.
Really? Yeah. I thought you were going to say the great state of Maine. No. I bet you that's near the top, though, isn't it?
No, Maine is number nine. It is. Yeah, it's number nine, so it is towards the top. So you guys are doing pretty good at there as far as UFOs go. But Oregon, you know, and we've gotten a lot of people from Oregon email us over the years and say, oh, we see them all the time. It's not even a big deal out here. So we've heard anecdotally that there are a lot of sightings. Interestingly enough, when I look at our archives for UFO stories, there aren't many. In fact, this year, I don't think the media wrote about UFOs once in Oregon that I'm aware of. I don't think we've talked about Oregon as far as UFO stories. So it's surprising that it should reach the top like that. Otherwise, number two is New Hampshire, a little higher than usual. Then we have New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, Alaska, Colorado, Missouri, Maine, and then West Virginia. So those were the top 10. But if you want to see your state, you can go to this story, and I listed every state in order. I also listed the countries. You know, this is data based off of MUFON reports. MUFON's mostly in the United States. They do have chapters in other countries and work closely with our neighbors. Mostly they got reports from English-speaking countries. Of course, you probably have a lot of UK listeners. We do, and we're talking about MUFON a lot. So Canada and then the UK reported a few hundred. Also India is pretty far up. They're interesting that they report to MUFON, and Australia. So lots of English speakers. And then I also looked at shapes. Spheres, circles, starlight are on the top, and then it comes to triangle. Disc shape is like number seven or something, and it's in between other and unknown. So disc shape is not the most popular. Triangles are more popular, and of course this year we've talked about several really cool triangular-shaped light or picture UFOs cases and videos. So.
Yeah, I think the disc, the flying saucer, is, you know, it's going out of style. It's becoming vintage.
They're upgrading to a delta shape or an orb. And you know what we get a lot of, and I don't know that people realize this. It seems like, and I've heard anecdotally personally in my life this the most and have seen this the most, what most people see is a star-like object, kind of like a satellite, but that just does very strange maneuvers, bobs around and then darts off, you know. That seems to be a very popular type of sighting.
Right, right. So, hey, that's great that you put all this effort into this list and break it down like that. That's very much appreciated, actually.
Thank you.
And that list will be linked in our show notes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, siree. So what else is happening?
Another big story that's really hitting the news right now, Jason got on really early, is this gentleman who uploaded to YouTube a video of what looks like a fireball or some sort of space junk. coming into the atmosphere and breaking up. But then there's this little orb that kind of departs from it and cruises up. And it's a very strange video.
Right. It's like 42 minutes of blanked out space too, right?
It's actually more like 2 minutes of blank out space. It's about a 3-minute video, 30 seconds or 43 to be precise seconds are this sighting. And then it goes black. And the rest of the couple minutes is black, which is kind of weird.
It is.
I'm not sure why that's the case. The guy who posted it is named Ken Roberts, or that's the name of his YouTube accounts. When I looked at it, it didn't have very many hits. When I just looked at it earlier, just like within the hour, it's got over 1 million hits.
Oh, my God. You know, I sent that to Mark D'Antonio. You probably did, too. I haven't heard back from Mark yet on it, just to get his opinion of that, because that is incredible. And that's going to be – anyone listening can check that out through the link in our show notes as well.
Yeah, a lot of people feel that it's fake. This guy has not been in contact with anybody. The only person he was seemingly in contact with was someone who wanted to buy the video and asked to repost it and must have paid the guy. Otherwise, he hasn't talked to many people, and he's disabled comments. So that's kind of suspicious that he's not giving people more information. And a lot of the people, the D'Antonios of the world, are saying they think it's even CGI interesting enough. So we'll probably hear back from hear some more from people as time goes on. But yeah, really interesting sighting that's making a lot of news right now.
Yeah, and if that is CGI, it's a pretty darn good job, I have to say. And it makes it tougher and tougher, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, it makes it, as we've talked about, it is harder and harder. And one person got frustrated and posted, why is it incumbent upon the person who takes the video to substantiate its reality? And it's like, well, whose job would it be then? And some people don't care. I took this video and you make what you want. And I can understand that because, you know, just because you take a video doesn't mean you're any sort of video expert. But there are so many hoaxes out there that are so convincing. It's just really, really hard.
Right. Absolutely. And we have hotspots. Is that the one you already talked about?
That was the first one I talked about.
Okay.
The last story I was going to talk about, and we've kind of talked about it again, but this is another phase, and I think we ought to mention it. But this is Stephen Bassett of the Paradigm Research. You know, he's done his Citizens Hearing Part 2, Phase 2 thing going on. And now he has added a petition to the We the People White House thing there again. This is the seventh time he's done this. And I think he was inspired because one time he was successful the first time he did it.
That's
because
right.
Back then you only needed 5,000 signatures. They keep raising it. Now you need 100,000 signatures to get any attention. The most he ever got was 12,000, so certainly a long shot. But, yeah, he's done this several times. The first time he actually prompted a response from the science, the science guy in charge of science at the White House. I forget his full title. And they said that there is no proof of extraterrestrial life. So essentially he is now – the wording he is using is he's asking the Obama administration to support congressional hearings for government agency political witnesses to extraterrestrial-related events and evidence.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe – you know, I look at it this way. You know, yes, this is the seventh time, but he's trying to do something, you know. I give him an A for effort, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, he's out there. He's doing what he does. It gets attention. It gets news stories, I'm sure. I haven't seen any on this, but there probably will be. I think it would be nice to see them kind of evolve. Like, I think it would be good to give them a reason because it's like, okay, well, why? And there really is no why in here. But I think it would be good to emphasize why this would be important. But that would be helpful for people. But, sure. I guess, you know, like you said, he's out there and he's doing his thing and bringing some awareness. And so we'll see what happens. Hopefully, you know, it'd be great if, it brought some people out of the woodwork that were some witnesses to some incredible stuff, some credible witnesses that could share some of their stories.
Absolutely. Well, that's it for the news today, right?
That is it for the news today.
Well, you stay warm out there. Don't, you know. Don't get too chilly in your light jacket, in your spring jacket.
Oh, no. It was too warm for my jacket today. So I left it at home.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, so.
All right.
You're the one who needs to stay warm, buddy.
I know. Hey, man, I'll talk to you next week.
All right. Talk to you next week, buddy.
Have a good one.
Adios.
All right, we have a longtime listener and fan of the show sent us some music that he creates, and his name's Bruce Rainier. Thank you, Bruce. And after this clip, stay tuned for Dr. Artie Clark coming right up. Artie Clark, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, and for the person that is not familiar with your work, we're going to be talking about your book on Mesoamerica, and the name of the book is called Sky People, Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica. I'm excited to talk about that, but can you give our listening audience basically your background, because you have quite an educational background and an interesting one as well.
Well, you know, I have a degree in English and a degree in history. I have a psychology degree, and I'm a licensed therapist and counselor. And I have a doctorate in school leadership. And I've been a high school English teacher, a counselor, a school administrator, a university administrator, and professor of educational leadership. And my 30 years at MSU, Montana State University, I was also the director of the Center for Bilingual Multicultural Education that served approximately 25 different Native American tribal groups throughout the Northwest region.
And you were really
even down into Arizona.
Uh-huh. So you've been really immersed in Native American culture as well over the years.
Oh, yes.
Which
and that's my background too. You know, I mean, I come from that heritage. So obviously I have a tremendous interest in indigenous people as a whole. And that's what my first book focused on was Native Americans and in the United, you know, in the 48 states plus Alaska, and then this book focuses on indigenous people in Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico.
Right, right, and we'll be talking more about your first book in the second hour of the show. What sparked your interest? To me, it seems to me that there's been a lot of history passed down in the Native American culture of Sky People. Did you somehow hear this in the beginning somewhere? in your travels. And is that what sparked your interest, or how did you get going on this subject?
Well, you know, when I was a little girl, you know, I heard the stories of the star people. You know, as all little girls, you go to college and, you know, you put those stories aside and you begin your career. And when I came to Montana State as an assistant professor back some over 30 years ago now, one of my jobs as a director of the Center for Bilingual Education was to go out and to recruit Native American students to come to the university and to study teaching and educational leadership. Because when I came, first moved to Montana, there were very few Native American teachers teaching on the reservation. And our goal was to get a group of teachers that would return, Native teachers who would return to the reservation and teach and, you know, set examples and be role models for students. And on my first trip out for recruitment, I stopped in this one village, and this person had agreed to serve as the organizer to bring all the students together from his reservation that were interested in teaching degrees. And I was offering scholarships as well, so I had written grants and gotten money from the federal government for this underserved population, and I could offer them scholarships. And so after we finished, after I finished interviewing the students and giving them applications and everything, he asked me if I wanted to go out to dinner. So we drove to a neighboring town and we had dinner. And on the way back, he said, you know, if you got a few minutes, I'd like to show you something. And I said, sure. And so he took me up in the mountains on this narrow dirt road. And he said, now, if we're lucky, they'll come.
Hmm.
And so he reached over and got a pair of binoculars. And we went out and we sat on this boulder overlooking his village. And he began to tell me about how the ancestors, the Star people, often come over his village. And I was just astounded because I had grown up hearing stories of Star people, but I had no idea that other tribal groups had similar stories. And so I began exploring that idea, looking for legends and talking to elders about ancient legends. And what I did is, in the process, I began collecting stories of contemporary encounters. And I was just fascinated at the stories that I was collecting. And I really was doing it as just a personal hobby. Even though I kept notes and I taped most of the stories. And after I retired from MSU, I was offered a year after I retired, or 2 years after, to be an evaluator of a federal grant that had been $5 million that had been funded on an Indian reservation. So I went to D.C. and I got trained by the officials back there to do the evaluation. And incidentally, that was my cost, not the taxpayers or the project. I paid for it myself. And I went back there and got the training. And then the next week after I got back, I went to the reservation. And at noon that first day I was there, I was invited to participate in a luncheon with several of the Native tribal leaders, female tribal leaders. And as we're sitting there talking, and something came up about a UFO that was seen on the reservation, or I'm not quite sure what brought it up. But anyway, I began telling them a couple of the stories that I had collected over the years. And this one lady looked at me and she said, what are you going to do with those stories? And I said, well, I really don't have any plans. And she said, well, what's going to happen to them after you pass? And I said, well, it'll probably be just thrown away. And she said, you know, you have a responsibility to write a book about this, because she said, this is our oral history, and it should be preserved. And I was really in a dilemma, because on the way back home, I knew I couldn't do both. I had just retired, you know, I'd only been out of retirement for a year. I couldn't commit myself to a five-year evaluation and write a book. And I thought, well, what is the most important? Well, there are a lot of evaluators out there, but there was no one that had the stories that I had. And so the next day I notified them that I really appreciated the offer, but that I wanted them to get another evaluator. And I sat down and started writing the book, and I've been writing ever since.
Wow. Wow. And so when you finished this book, which, again, we're going to talk about in the second hour, the reason we're speaking tonight is because someone read that particular book and loved it and suggested that I contact you. This is a longtime UFO researcher. He's been at it for, in the 60s, I think, early 60s. Loved your first book and really enjoyed it. So you ended up, I read briefly, we're in the Mesoamerican area, geographical area. You traveled 20-some-odd thousand miles speaking to people.
Yeah, you know, after I retired at MSU, well, shortly before I retired, one of the things that I had always had in my mind when I was a teenager in a high school, a teacher handed me a book entitled Incidents of Travel in Central America, the Chiapas and the Yucatan. And it was by a man named John L. Stevens. And Stephen Catherwood was the artist, the illustrator for this book. And Stephen Catherwood was an architect by trade and had traveled throughout the Middle East recording all the ancient architectural structures in the Middle East. And so when Stevens had heard about these ancient cities that were hidden in the jungle in Central America and Mexico, and he made a decision that he was going to go down there and find out if the stories were true. And he invited Catherwood to go along with him to draw these cities. And when I read the book, I just absolutely fell in love with this story. It just was mesmerizing. And I went back to my teacher and I said, when I grow up, I'm going to follow in their footsteps. I'm going to go to all those places. Well, she said, well, you know, you might want to read their second book. And it was Incidents of Travel in the Yucatan. And it chronicled their second trip. And it was only in Mexico that they traveled when they went the second time. The first time they landed in Belize City, which was at that time British Honduras. Now today Belize City is in the country of Belize. And there is a separate Honduras and Guatemala and Mexico. So they made that trip, and I followed their trip. But if I heard stories or had a particular interest, just like they did, I veered off of my plan and took off in another direction, which, as you know, often leads you to some of the most revealing stories of all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that I was going to fulfill that teenage dream. And so I set off to do that and started out in Belize. I followed in their footsteps, or at least I should say what I did was I went to every single site that they had visited, if it still existed. And they visited something like 44, 45 sites, and I visited 89. So you can see that my my travel was much more expensive. But on the other hand, I traveled for 7 years to that part of the country frequently, you know, staying anywhere from 2 weeks to a month at a time to investigate, often embedding myself, you know, in villages and staying so that people felt comfortable with me. And I played with their children and I ate meals with them and I attended ceremonies and went to funerals and went to wedding celebrations and all sorts of things so that people felt comfortable with who I was. And the stories began to emerge. And I can't begin to tell you how important it was for me to have the drivers and the guides and the interpreters who accompanied me or whom I hired when I got to a particular site to assist me, because they were just invaluable in terms of providing me access, introducing me, validating me, and people, you know, protecting me, basically. And so it was an unbelievable experience.
It really sounds it. Now, how did you handle the language? I'm sure that you have had to deal with several languages.
I did, you know, well, at least several dialects.
Dialects, I mean, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I also interviewed some Zapotecs, so, you know, the Zapotec language was mixed in there, and the Mixtec, who has a different language, and the Maya has several dialects. How I handled that is one of the requirements for a driver was that they spoke English, Spanish, and at least one native dialect. And I had one guide that spoke six different dialects of the Maya language, as well as Spanish, English, and French thrown in. So, you know, he was highly skilled linguistically. But if I came to a community where I didn't have a speaker, I hired somebody in that community who was a speaker, and it's rather interesting because throughout my travels I ran onto people who spoke English, particularly younger people, because many of them had lived in the United States. I mean, several of my people I hired as drivers or guides or interpreters had lived in the United States, had come into the United States as illegals, but after they got a certain amount of money and were able to go home and build a small home for their mother or for their family, whatever, returned because they spoke of the fear of living here and being an illegal, and how they could never really relax because they were always afraid they were going to get caught. So they would come here and earn money and get out. And then with the benefit of the English language then at their disposal, they were able to get into the tourist industry or become a guide or a driver or whatever when people like me came along and needed assistance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that helped out in that way. Now, were there parts of the places that you went where there was early, it's sort of like tribal conditions, like people separated from the rest of a society?
Well, the Lankandon Maya, who live, it's about maybe 50 miles from Palenque, which is in the Chiapas, up in the mountains in the Chiapas. They were a group of the Maya who entered, you know, separated themselves so much from the rest of the, you know, of their group, and have carried on their ways of life, their religion, their, ancient practices, even in, you know, until today. They still dress as they always did. They have long hair. Both the men, women, and children all have long, straight hair, It's not braided. It just falls down their back. They wear these, I'm not sure what they're made out of, but they look like homespun cotton gowns. They all dress alike, the men, women, children. And it's just like a gown that comes down to their ankle and just a hole with sleeves in it, short sleeves. You know, I met several groups and villages. Every village, when you get into the highlands and a lot of those mountain villages, they all have a distinctive way of dress. And I had people, women tell me, describe to me what their dresses meant, the symbolism behind their dresses. A lot of it has to do with the cosmos and the stars. And I met one group, and you know they live kind of, this village, they kind of almost live in a fort of seclusion. They have a history of murdering the only Catholic priest that ever came to their village. They defeated the Spaniards. Now, they were up in Oaxaca, and they defeated the Spaniards by pouring. They had this fort built around their village, and they literally would go up on top of the fort and pour boiling water and boiling oil over on the Spanish soldiers. No Mexican policeman is even allowed in this community. They have their own laws. And if you as a visitor, and they allow visitors to come, and of course you got to pay, and everything you do, you have to pay. You have to pay to get into the village. You have to pay to go to the church. And they allow that, but once you're in there, you're vulnerable to their laws. And if you do something you're not supposed to do, you know, it can mean your life. And so my drivers and guides were very careful, say, do this, what to wear, what not to do, mm-hmm. because, you know, I mean, there's records of, people being killed, tourists being killed, and the police will not do anything about it because they have no authority, and the U.S. government won't do anything about it. So if you go into some of these, you know, communities, and then, you know, they have a history of exiling anyone within their community who marries outside their community. And I found that to be fairly common in some of those isolated villages in Oaxaca, particularly in the state of Oaxaca.
I'm sure. I want to apologize to people listening live. I understand through the chat room that the sound keeps dropping. I've been trying to reach the producer, and so he, when he gets back, and I'm sure he'll fix that. And again, I apologize. And if you are listening live, you are welcome to jump in the chat room if you'd like to pose a question to our guest. You just go to podcastufo.com, and it's a two-click sign-up. The chat room's right there on the sidebar. So let's jump right in and talk about one of the stories. I'd love to hear some of these stories, and it doesn't necessarily have to be your favorite one that you have, but I just want to hear a variety of what these people have been saying.
Well, let's start with Belize, because that's the first country I visited. Now, I had no language problem in Belize, because Belize is an English-speaking nation, the only one in that part of the world. And I had heard a story when about a stone woman. And the local legend says around the end of the 1800s, a young man from the village went hunting, and as he approached the ancient city, which was the ancient, their village was not in the ancient city, but as he approached the ancient city, and he crossed the base of the castillo, which is the pyramid, that beneath the base of the pyramid there was a cavern. And there standing at the base of this pyramid was this beautiful, statuesque Maya woman dressed in a long, flowing white dress. and that she had red glowing eyes, but that she did not move. That's how she earned the name the Stone Woman. Well, according to the young hunter, she sparked in the rays of the rising sun, and he was so awestruck by her appearance that he threw his gun aside and he ran to the village and told the people all about this beautiful woman of stone. And several villagers, including the local priest or shaman, went to the site. And when they arrived there, they found the mouth of the cave, but the Stone Woman had disappeared. Well, occasionally the Stone Woman reappears, and I happened to be in that part of the world one time when there was a recent account of a local shaman reporting the Stone Woman was seen again, and that he saw her ascending to a large silver disc that hung over the ancient site. Others that witnessed the event said they saw her climb the pyramid and disappear inside a wall. And even though Stevens and Catherwood had not ventured to this site, I decided to take that trip because I wanted to get the lowdown, so to speak, on what was going on. And so my guide and I headed out to the village, and the priest was not home, but she told us where that we could find him at the ancient site. So in order to get there, you have to take this hand crank ferry over the Mopon River. And so we got on this ferry, and we cranked our way across the river, and when you're there, you're less than like a mile from Guatemala. It's that close to the Guatemalan border, but there's no road to get there. They estimate that this place was probably abandoned around 1000 A.D. Well, we located the shaman, who agreed to tell us the story, and he explained that for several weeks, the residents had been seeing strange flying objects over the town. And the villagers called the objects circles that blocked the sun. And reportedly, there was a light radiating from underneath the craft, which pulsated from a bright yellow to a blinding blue light. But there was no sound coming from the craft, so they called it the circles that blocked the sun. And then after several weeks, the sightings had set the people on edge. And so he said that the people had spent much of their time in church praying because they weren't sure what was going on. And I asked him, I said, well, was this the time that the Stone Woman appeared? And he said, yes. And he said from the first time she was spotted, the elders talked about a strange flying machine that circled the sky. And I said, well, the stories of her originated in the 1800s. Did those stories also talk about a flying saucer? And he said, as long as he could remember, the elders have said the Stone Woman comes from the sky. And they said she is a sky woman. And I said, well, what can you tell me about the most recent event? And he said, well, it was a Sunday morning, and the people were headed to church when the craft came over the village at a very slow speed. And I said, well, can you tell me any details? And he said, well, it was round. It had no wings. And I said, well, did you see the one called the Stone Woman? And he said, I saw a woman, and she was magnificent. And he said, she glowed like the stars. She was the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. He said she descended from the craft on a beam of light. And she stood at the entrance of the pyramid and walked inside the cave. And he said when she emerged, she climbed to the top of Castillo, and a beam of light came down, and she entered the craft just as she had emerged from it. And I said to him, I said, well, were you the only witness? And he said, well, there were several others. But some of them said she walked inside the pyramid and disappeared. But he said, I know the truth because I avoided her eyes. And I said, well, what do you mean you avoided her eyes? And he said, she has red glowing eyes, and she has the ability that if you look at it into her eyes, she has a power over you that makes you see what she wants to see. And he said, so I knew that. And so I didn't look in her eyes. And so I was able to see what was actually going on, where she made the other people see what she wanted them to see. So that was the story of the Stone Woman of Belize. And, you know, based on an ancient story, I asked him, I said, do you believe the original story that she was a woman of stone? And he said, I don't believe she was. He said, I think the young hunter who first saw her was so dazzled by her beauty, she made him think she was a woman of stone. He said, the people from the stars have great powers, more than those of us on Earth. And he said, I believe she is a living, breathing star goddess who cast a spell on those who saw her and made them believe what she wanted them to believe. Hmm. And he said she was taller than our women. She had black hair that flowed down the back to her waist. She wore a long white dress with embroidery. And but he said, I wasn't close enough to recognize the designs of her embroidery. And as I mentioned before, that was very important because each village has its own way of dress in many parts of that of Mesoamerica that identifies where they're from. And as I said, the women, you know, to us, they may look like floral designs or abstract designs, but the women tell me that in the old days, the traditional way of embroidering your dress had to do with your connection with the cosmos and the star system. Hmm. So that was one of the stories I thought that was interesting, you know. And I met a man in Belize who told me that he had a double on another planet, that he had actually been cloned, and for the purposes, and he grew up with this child who was his clone, and this clone learned everything from him, and then the idea being that the spacemen were literally populating another planet. And he was going to be one that they would use, that his clone would populate, be a part of that population. So some interesting stories out of Belize.
Yes, and let's go into some of the other countries. Well, let me ask you this. This just occurred to me. Were there commonalities in some of these stories spread apart in different areas and different countries as you were traveling?
Well, you know, I think, you know, sometimes the description of the aliens they encountered, or the description of the craft, but there were similarities with other stories that you've heard in the U.S., like the different kinds of aliens. I think we could say some of them were the tall whites, and some of them were the little gray men, and some of them were lizard-like men, or more lizard than human, or you know, human-like. But and then I heard stories of women being abducted and impregnated, but not necessarily, you know. It ran the whole gamut of different kinds of things that, you know, to say the only commonality would be the encounters, you know, that they had encounters with, but they varied so distinctly.
Right. Uh-huh. And when you were also speaking to the people there, were there any incidents that happened, you know, fairly, you know, not that long ago, like, in other words, a recent encounter?
Well, there was one encounter that occurred, you know, in Honduras when I was there. And I was staying in this kind of boutique hotel. My driver from Belize had taken me to Honduras, to Copan, which it was the first site that Stevens and Catherwood had visited. And so my plan was, you know, I had arranged for a driver to pick me up in Copan and take me to Guatemala, but I did not have a driver once I got to Copan, because the city is actually called Copan Ruinous, and then the ancient site is called Copan. To me, it felt like it should have been the opposite, but that's the way it was. There were enough people there who spoke English, too, because there is a bilingual school there that teaches English and Spanish. And what's interesting is they attract all of these students, these English-speaking students from all over the world, particularly from the UK, to come there and teach in their school for minimum rewards, and I think perhaps room and board. And these kids are all learning English. And I had a lady approach me and say to me that she said, "Do you know, if you go into Copan at night, if you go into the site at night, the ancestors will come if you are indigenous." And she said, "You are indigenous." I said, "Yes, USA." And she said, "Well, the priest said you would come." And I said, "Are you talking about the Catholic priest?" And she said, "No, I'm talking about our priest in my village." She says, "I live in the mountains, up away from the city." And she began to tell me that they had fallen on hard times. And this was around 2008 when economy had really tanked, and people weren't traveling as much to that part of the world, and their economy had suffered because the people there depend so much on the tourist industry. And so she told me their priest had said that a woman was coming from the north, El Norte, and that this woman was going to be very kind. And she said, "I know you're that woman." And I said, "Well, I know. I can't be that woman. I'm just a professor. I'm not anybody." And she said, "Oh no, you are." She said, "You know, I see how you treat people. I see how you talk to the children. I see how you leave tips. I see how you speak to people." So she just insisted that I was the woman that her priest had predicted would come to their village. And she said, "Tonight my brother will come for you, and he will take you into this city. And if you have a kind heart and you are that woman, the ancients will come." And I said, "Well, who are the ancients? You mean the star people?" And she said, "See, they will come." And so about midnight, her brother, Teodoro, Doro, knocked on the door, and he led me into the jungle. And we climbed this pyramid in the dark, and we sat there. And I could hear the bats, you know, below, and I could see the stars that just seemed, you know, unbelievably bright, sitting there on that pyramid. And he says, "Now we wait." And along before dawn, all of a sudden these lights appeared, and they were like they were cavorting in the plaza. And there were several of them, maybe 20, just almost like they were dancing. They were, and he and Teodoro says, "They're here." And then one of them broke away from the rest of the group and came right in front of me. And the others lined up behind this light. And then all of a sudden, the sun came up and they disappeared. And I looked up overhead, and there was a wheel-like craft circling above the plaza. It covered the entire space. Now, one of the plazas, I forget, is what, four or five football fields. It was rotating very slowly, and then all of a sudden, it accelerated and it took off and was gone. Well, I'm just dumbfounded, and my guide Teodoro says, "You're one of us." And so we're walking back to the village, and he's trying to say, "Will you go with me tomorrow night?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm a driver is coming for me today, this morning. I'm on my way to Guatemala." And so he made me promise that I would return, because he says, "You know, you have brought prosperity to our village, because this is what the priest said, that when this woman from the north would come, she would, and she visited with the ancients, that when the ancients appeared to her, that meant that the village would be prosperous again." And so when we were driving out of the village, I remember my driver saying to me, "Did you see the UFO last night?" And he said, "I was in Guatemala, and we saw it, and it was headed toward Copan." And, you know, I didn't even respond to him, because I'm thinking about what I had just seen. We got to Guatemala City. I was so exhausted. I had dinner, went to the hotel, and went to bed. And the next morning, I found out that craft, I assume it was the same craft, had circled over the hotel that night. Hmm. And there were probably 20 or 30 people who had witnessed this craft that I described to you. It was the same one they described to me, that had hovered over the hotel that night and had actually taken one of the waiters on board the craft. So his story is also in the book.
Wow. So we're just about 3 minutes away from the top of the hour. And so just one question came up on the message board, and it would be nice to get the answer from you. Any of these people that were having these encounters, did they claim to receive any message from the beings that they encountered?
The only messages, and this only came from maybe two or three of the people, was that the people had not taken very good care of the earth, and that in the future we would have to pay the consequences for our mistakes.
Boy, I'll tell you what, you hear that in the South African, Rwanda, I believe that's what it was.
And case. Even in the Native American, you know, I've heard that.
Yeah, you hear it everywhere, and that's something that really makes you wonder. And, you know, it's actually common sense as well. You know, we are ruining our planet. So, you know, it's just that... we're in a society that lives for today, you know, and I brought this up, you know, before when we were talking about nuclear power. You know, we use, like, the power we need for just today, but we put the burden out there for 250,000 years of people to take care of the waste, you know, that type of stuff. So, yeah, we're not treating our planet very nicely, that's for sure.
And that's basically the message you know, I heard from the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just got a couple minutes left in this hour. Is before we jump into the next hour and talk about the Native American culture and your first book, is there another quick story you can tell us from one of the people?
Well, you know, in Honduras as well, I met this elder, and he was he spoke English, you know, perfectly. And I asked him how he had learned English so well, and he said that when he was a small boy, he said, "I was born in 1904. And he said, when I was 5 years old, Herbert Spinden. And Herbert Spinden was the assistant curator of anthropology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And Herbert Spinden came to Copan, and he spent 20 years there from 1909 to 1929. So Luis was 5 years old when he first arrived there. And he said, and he was, at the time I interviewed him, he was 99 years old. He said, I worked at this site for almost 75 years. And he said, Spinden was the first to hire me. And he said, mostly in those days, I was a runner. I would go get him water, and I would bring lunches to the site. And he said, I worked all day for 10 cents a day. And he said, but Spinden told me that if I learned English, he would pay me more money. And he says, by the time I was 8, I spoke English. And he raised my salary to 25 cents a day. And he paid me 25 cents a day until he left. And he said, then the Carnegie scientists came to excavate and restore the city. And he said, they paid me 50 cents a day because I could speak English. And he said that on the weekends when the scientists took time off, he and his friends would go up into the mountains above Copan. And, you know, I'm talking about really extensive mountain ranges in that area, and they would go up into those mountains, and there were a lot of caves, and they would go into these caves to see if they could find any artifacts, because if they did, they would bring them back, and the archaeologists would pay them for them. They would buy them from them. And he said, I was about 11 or 12, and he said, we would go up there. He said, my cousins and I found this skeleton of a man in a silver suit. And he said his suit was silver from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. And he said, but all that remained inside the suit was a skeleton. And he said, from the size of the suit, he was a small man. And I estimated, because he was motioning how tall he was, that he was probably about a meter tall. And he said his head was covered in a hard metal-like tube. And he said there were strange tablets beside him and with strange characters on it. And he said it was not Mayan writing, because we knew what Mayan writing looked like. And he said this writing was foreign to us. And he said when we showed it to the archaeologists, they didn't know what it was either. And I said, well, tell me more about the helmet. And he said, well, the best he could describe it, it was like a large coffee can, but that was the shape of it, but it was bigger than a coffee can. And he said it was attached to the suit, and it had a hose that attached to the front of the suit. And he said there were different color buttons on the front of the breast of the suit. And I said, well, what did you do with it? And he said, well, we carried it back to the archaeologists, and he said they were really excited. He said they took it into one of their tents, and they began examining it. And he said he heard one of the archaeologists say that they had to send it back to the USA immediately. And he said the next day I saw a box in the tent. And he said, I think they packed him up and shipped him to their university. And he said, I never saw him again. And he said, all of my life I have felt guilty about the Silver Man. And he said, I'm sure the scientist in the USA has studied and restudied him, but they keep it a secret. And he said, I believe it's proof that alien exists, don't you? And he said, I feel so bad because it was such an important part. Now that I'm an old man, he says, I know it was such an important part of proving the Maya connection with the stars. And then he went on to tell me that his grandfather always told him about these men who came from the stars and who lived in the mountains sometimes for months, and that they never bothered the people in the village, so the people in the village never bothered them. And he said they came in silver discs that spit fire, and the men wore silver suits. And he said, I think we discovered one of those who died on one of those visits. And they buried him in a cave, and we disturbed his gravesite. So,
wow.
Again, that's an amazing story.
It really is. Well, you know, that's it for this part of the show, and we'll be back. What's the name of the book we're going to be discussing in the second half of the show?
Encounters with Star People.
It's Native American, basically, yes?
Right. It's on stories I collected in the U.S.
So that's it for our show. And just remember, you can sponsor us for $1 a month or more to listen to the second part of the show as a podcast on GetJoyRide.com. And we want to thank a few people today, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse and Bruce Rainier for the music, and Peggy Shunning for managing the Facebook page. Remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. We have Mark Schwartz next week with Truth Funders, and he'll be on right here at 8 p.m. on the Dark Matter Radio Network next week, Wednesday, Eastern Standard Time, that is. And we'll see you next week. This is Martin Willis, and we're signing off. Keep your eyes to the sky.
Bye-bye, Martin.